Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and apologies from Neil Thornton, who is recovering from a minor operation. So any of the really dull slides are definitely Neil's, and the great ideas are definitely mine. Difficult questions for him by email, if you would like. I'm going to skate over climate change policy and how it's developed fairly quickly in the last couple of years. I'm going to talk a bit about the science, because the science is a very important part of the government's climate policy agenda. Mention a little bit about the adaptation subcommittee, and then Graham will take it from there. So, the science. This is the basic argument. This is the Hadley Centre modelling, and you can see a temperature there in 2003, when there was something like 35,000 deaths brought forward in Europe from a heatwave. Now, we're already committed, because of CO2 emissions in the atmosphere and the inertia of the system, to the 2040 emissions. And projections from the modelling suggest that 2003 temperatures will be average temperatures in 2040. So there is a significant change to adapt to. The key thing here is, and this is the kind of strap line at the top, if you like, mitigation is vital. This is what our ministers would say. But we need to prepare for inevitable climate change. And that inevitability, the inertia in the system, is something that is often not appreciated. If we stop everything tomorrow with respect to carbon emissions, there is decades of change to come. And that's the issue. Is anyone sceptical about this? My team were the team whose emails were hacked during ClimateGate. And that was a question that we had a lot of dealings with a couple of years ago. And I remember at the time Sir Brian Hoskins of the Committee on Climate Change saying, well, of course I'm a sceptic, I'm a scientist. That's the way we think. Science is organised scepticism. But it did lead to a fascinating and massive media issue. Characterised, if you like, by a question of belief or not. And the problem with that is, and also uncertainty, kind of paralysis of uncertainty. Tell us the exact answer and we'll act. If you're uncertain, then we'll wait until you're certain. Now, we spend, 17, 18 million pounds a year at the Hadley Centre. We could double that investment. And we may not reduce uncertainty by a great deal. Apologies for Met Office colleagues in the audience if you're hearing that. But there's a real issue about uncertainty. And I've seen this best described by a school teacher in the US, a guy called Craig Craven. If you look at the box on the left, follow the line from left to right, proof. If it's a question of proof or belief, you believe or not, you have to wait for certainty, and that will never happen. If you look down vertical the line, do we take climate action or not? Is this true or not? You have a situation, you ask the question, what's the worst that could happen? And the worst that could happen is we don't take any action, and it's true. Costs are, I heard Professor Grubb recently say at one of these meetings, uncountable, so uncountable that he believes cost-benefit analysis is not a useful approach to try and estimate it. What's the worst that could happen? Huge costs. What's the next worst that could happen? Well, it's not true, and we spend a fair amount of money preparing for it. That's the bottom left-hand corner there. The 1% of GDP was the Stern estimate. And when the Stern review came out, that was, I guess, a vast amount of money, and no one could believe that anyone would decide to spend that sort of money. Now, in the intervening period, we've lost, say, in between 14 and 17% of GDP to the credit crunch and the ensuing financial crisis. Suddenly, 1% looks doable. That's quite an interesting perspective. And one of the benefits of running this kind of work in government and spending a lot of money on science is you have great opportunities to talk a lot with people who violently disagree with you, many of whom are in the audience tonight. And after denying, you eventually realise, oh yes, they're absolutely right about a lot of things. One of these people is Prof. Lenny Smith, and I acknowledge him for the bit on the right. He sort of put this paradigm that we need to get out of this science paradigm of predicting the future, waiting until the predictions are perfect, then optimising our decision, and then we can relax and get on with things, into more of a risk-based paradigm, which I'm sure our third speaker will characterise much better than I can. Assess the risks, hedge your bets on the best available evidence, then sometime later do it again. And that's a much more interesting paradigm to think about with respect to policymaking. And the Climate Change Act is set up like that. It has set 5-year cycles. It's a risk-based framework. So with this massive challenge of adaptation, what's the role of government? Government will certainly need to act. The government owns and manages lots of assets and interests. Government uniquely can generate large amounts of evidence with large amounts of highly capable scientists. Hadley Centre, we've been doing that for 20 years now, and it's a world-leading centre. And also, sort of third line there, market failures. Government has a role to act in market failures, things like flood defence and so on. And I think this is a complex issue. It manifests itself across the entire economy. We lead it from DEFRA, but we don't say this is an environmental issue. We say it's an economic issue. When it snowed last Christmas, it cost £600 million a day, according to British Chambers of Commerce. It's an economic issue. And the big issue is infrastructure investment, things that you invest in that will sit there for 100, 200 years. And the world that they exist in will change dramatically. So there is a big role of government, I think, in looking at this complex issue and trying to make sure that the what we expect the market to do in this complex world is looked at and not lost. So we have a statutory framework, the Climate Change Act, and box on the left, it includes the setup of the Adaptation Subcommittee, a independent group of experts who advise us, criticise us, and help us, I think, is the most important thing. We also have a reporting power. We can ask companies to tell us about their climate risks. And the Act also specifies that we'll do a climate change risk assessment, and H.R. Wallingford, who sponsored this meeting, lead the consortium. And I should say, it's one of those boiling the ocean projects. It's a very, very difficult project, and they've done a heroic job in doing that for us. We're almost complete on the risk assessment, and the Adaptation Subcommittee have been advising us heavily on that. And then finally, in a year's time, after the risk assessment, we'll have a new national adaptation policy program. So the next year and a bit is developing that program. It's not in the statutory framework, but we also, many of you are familiar with the UK climate projections, which we developed with the Met Office and others in 2009. And we will also do an economics analysis. It's no good just knowing what the possible maximum vulnerability is. We need to know what it's going to cost. So, risk-based decision-making. The policy cycle and the way that it's set up is very much like a risk cycle. So it's a 5-year thing. We don't need to get everything right in one go. It follows. We can try our best, and then we'll revisit and revisit and revisit. So it is a risk cycle. And we have some tests. Where do we need to act? Does it really matter? Our risk assessment tries to help us do that. Does it matter now? And that's really about decision-making. Many of these dramatic effects might happen in decades to come or 50 to 100 years. So why should we act now? And I mentioned infrastructure. That's the main reason. Decisions that you take now that will have a long-term consequence. And does it really matter to government? We're not the only actor. There are plenty of others. And we share the view of the ASC, the Adaptation Subcommittee, that we are also looking for low regrets options, things that we can do that will work under any circumstances. And in DEFRA, we see our role as mainstreaming this kind of thinking, risk-based decision-making about the climate in the rest of government. So it's not all for government. We have central government, which plays its role. The coalition majors on big society and localism. Local government has a strong role to play. I've just noticed that the bins are in the local government bit. It's not all about weekly bin collections. Business, at least two of the buildings right in the middle there, one of them is Lloyds and one of them is Willis Ree, and we have interesting relationships with them both and learn a lot from them. Both beautiful buildings in their own special way. And of course communities are heavily involved in adaptation, particularly after events, flooding and so on. So every part of society has a strong role to play. What decisions matter now? What decisions matter long term? Many impacts will be gradual, and it is really the core competence of people to adapt to change. That's what people do. So many things people will just do anyway. The creeping out in London, cafes on the pavements and so on, it's an interesting fashion. B&Q 10 years ago didn't sell any air conditioners, and now they do, seasonally. So people adapt, and that happens. Many risks and opportunities are for markets and commercial players to judge. They do that best. There are great opportunities in adaptation for business. There's a huge export market. Most of the rest of the world will be much more severely affected than us. So there is a lot of business in helping other people to adapt. And the insurance industry, construction industry, consultancy industry, there's a big role to play both locally and overseas. So the effects can be dramatic. It happens across, I mentioned the economy, it happens across society, big environmental issues, and issues where those things converge, like the classic water, people, energy. We'll have more people, we'll have more energy demands, we'll need more water, and there'll be less water. So managing those terrible convergences is a major policy issue. There's been a lot more damage in the last few decades. In the last 30 years, I believe, of Europe, damage to the or damage costs have doubled. A lot of that is due to more assets on the ground. There is more wealth, not quite right now, but there has been traditionally over decades more wealth from one year to the next. So it's not just about the climate. It's about what happens underneath, what happens to society, and where people live, how they live, what they invest in, what they build. There's more exposure to risk. Just to mention the reporting power, so one of the things that we try to do is to get a sense of what's happening in the market. What are big organisations doing? Are they cited on this? We've asked about, I think, 91 organisations to report to us on their climate risks, what they're doing, what actions they're taking, how they take account of this. In the important areas, water, energy, transport, regulators and public bodies. Final tranche of those is about to come in, but in general, it's been an interesting exercise, not just in looking at what they do, but in creating conversations amongst experts, like the Environment Agency, for example, who are experts in this kind of thing, the Howdy Centre, consultancies and scientists of various kinds, and the sectors have worked together on this kind of thing, and it's been really quite interesting seeing how that's happened. Major issue, which is quite hard to account for, and John Bennington recently published a report on this, is how we respond to global impacts. So overseas, the impacts will be much bigger. Markets and supply chains will be changed, disrupted. Businesses need to plan for that. There's a report about to come out on migration from Foresight in the Government Office of Science. There are many reports on migration. It's quite hard to get a handle on. One might expect major ecosystem disruption, biodiversity loss, invasive species, and so on. So there are huge international impacts, and John Bennington's Foresight report concluded that the data on that is really thin. The issues to really worry about are the kind of complex cascade failures. To dig into the science a bit, we've been investing in this in a long time, and again, it's one of the kind of fortes of government to do this kind of thing. Climate projections. We started with a major projection in 2002, major upgrade in 2009 with what we call probabilistic projections, and there are many critics of this, and we are well aware of all the strengths and limitations of this technique, but it is cutting edge. It is trying to break ground. Just to give you a feel for this, the single projection on the left, what we had in 2002, is like sampling 10 cards from a pack of playing cards, and there might be 3 red and 7 black, and you think that that's the situation. Oh, all packs of cards have 30% black. What we did with the new projections on the right is we effectively did that deal, those 10 cards, 10,000 times, and then took the average. And then you get a sense of what the real average of the underlying situation really is. The big caveat on that is, of course, this is sampling models. It's not sampling the real world. But that's a huge improvement. It showed us that our 2002 estimates were kind of somewhere on the left of the extreme. And it gives people a sense of the range and... you can change your sort of selection, if you like, based on what your risk appetite is. So different users can use them in different ways. It's a very sophisticated tool, quite hard to grasp initially, and it's really an expert user tool. But it's a major advance. The recent thing we're doing, the climate change risk assessment. So to take you very quickly through a long and complicated method, we start out with what are the big risks, big magnitude, big likelihood. This urgency thing I mentioned, what do we need to make decisions on in the next 5 or 10 years? What can we put off to the future where we might have better information? Then we did a sort of dose response based on existing information. How historically has a climate parameter affected that risk? And then we've projected that into the future with climate projections and emissions scenarios, IPCC scenarios. We looked at these risks around the UK. And then we've looked at effects on society, economy and environment, and we've added it all up, and we get that kind of barcode on the left. 100-odd top risks, magnitude, onset, and so on. Bob will criticise me if I don't tell you what the answers are. Not surprisingly, flooding is the major risk, and the flooding risk goes up and up and up. Water is another obvious major risk. And here's an example of water. So the bit on the left is what we have observed historically. The bit on the right is, I won't take you through this in detail, but the bit on the right is how you project. This is dryness, aridity, dryness into the future in different catchment areas. And we've traditionally thought that the southeast is going to be dry and the northwest will be okay because it always rains in Cumbria. But actually, when you look at what water companies can supply, so-called deployable outputs, it's the other way around. There's a lot of groundwater storage in the southeast, and there isn't much in the northwest. The Lake District is fairly mountainous, so actually the vulnerability is really in the northwest. And you see that when you look back, it seems obvious. Every year there is a drought and a flood in the northwest. So there are some sort of slightly non-obvious results. So we have these sorts of onset, what's going to look like in 2020s, 2050s, 2080s. We also have a confidence level. There's not a lot of data in many of these areas, so we thought adding confidence was useful. It tells people what we're sure about, what we're less sure about. And then we have 100 of these scores and about 11 volumes of information to tell you all about every sector we've looked at. And we'll build on this. Look at the kind of Stern-type graph on the left. The top line is what the risk assessment tells us. It's not actually potent vulnerability, it's potential vulnerability. Sorry for the spelling mistake there. And the economic approach will be to, okay, look at the potential vulnerability. Look at what policies are already in place that might handle some of that. Look at what the market might do by itself that might handle some of that. And then see what the deficit is and see what we can do about that. And this is our structure that's come from the risk assessment. We'll look at some environmental issues, built environment and infrastructure. There's real health issues, as we see from heat waves, and business and services, very important. And this now forms our policy framework. So from the risk assessment, kind of bottom-up look at what the risks are, we've framed our policy. All this science is all very well, and a lot of it is all very complicated. So how do we help people deal with it? Well, for many years, we've had the UK Climate Impacts Programme. One of the things that the Adaptation Subcommittee said to us in their first report was you need more action on the ground. You've done really well at science. UK CIP, UK Climate Impacts Programme, have done really well on sort of tools for helping people think about it, but you need to scale up. Financially, it's quite hard to scale up at the moment. So we've now shifted that effort from the UK Climate Impacts Programme to the Environment Agency, who have a national structure that we can exploit to try and scale up. And the Environment Agency launched their conversation with stakeholders a few weeks ago about how can we help you, what do you need? So this is about going the journey from the highly complex science to what do you need to make decisions in your organisation at the simplest level. And in many cases, even the conclusion, actually we don't need anything, it's not an issue for us, is a good answer to reach. We're not trying to tell everyone to care about adaptation, we're trying to find the people who need to care. So the Adaptation Subcommittee is also, again, they pointed out the obvious to us. Themes are useful, themes like business, environment, and so on. So we've recast our policy to make them sort of more accessible to people. So that's how we try to take all this heavy investment and make it useful and usable to people. Now, how will all this deep analysis feed into the National Adaptation Programme, and what will that be about? Well, my colleague Darius Campbell, sitting near the front, will hate me for saying this. We're going to produce a boring document. Here's an example of what it might look like. And it's about our objectives, our proposals, our policies, our timescales, so on and so forth. Traditional fare of the civil service. But Darius is heroically these days fashionably taking that and deconstructing it and saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to have collaborative policy making, and he started this already. We're going to have an open debate. We're not going to tell anybody what we think the answer is, because actually, we don't know. It's a highly complex topic, and many other people are experts. We're going to involve stakeholders. We're going to try to exploit the innovation that's already in the market to look for solutions. And this is all about co-creation. And it's not about what the government needs to do. It's about how can we identify what the problem is? and then help people who need to act, act. And some of that will be the government and much of that will not be. And a lot of that is about managing risks. A lot of that can also be about exploiting opportunities, which I'm sure our third speaker will tell us something about. Thank you very much.